Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So, what I was saying a moment ago will now be repeated in a somewhat more leisurely fashion. We are tonight going to be listening to some excerpts from tapes, or rather from podcasts, which are featured on the front page of the website for this program. Actually, they are just a taste of what is available. If you go to the linked pages, and there are many of them, there are literally hundreds of podcasts. All of the recent programs, of course, are up there. They rotate so that each week is there for about a week and then goes on the back page. But we also have what we are calling classic Extension 720 programs. I keep finding new ones going into the files on the old programs. But as I say, there are hundreds of them up already. And among them, on the front page, are all the ones you'll be hearing pieces of tonight. And I started with a conversation that I did with Wally Phillips back in 1985. I'm going to go directly back to that one. It only runs about 4 minutes, but I want you to hear all of it. It rouses wonderful memories. The man was a consummate genius in running radio and a very interesting mind as well. And here then, memories of Wally Phillips.
What's the secret of good talk radio?
I think respect. I think instead of utilizing those people waiting on 1-2-3-4 mm-hmm. lines as, hello, you're on the air, as a fodder for your own movement and ratings, if you treat that person with respect as though you were in his or her living room or car tearing apart the news of the day, it's an altogether different thing.
There's one thing and only one thing I think I've ever learned. I haven't learned to shut up and to curb my tendencies towards polysyllabic excess. I haven't learned to stop overindulging some of my own special interests.
I don't care about your polysyllabic excess. It's
just
big words.
I know. But one thing I think I've learned, and it's the only thing I could ever convey about how to do a talk radio program, is listen. Listen, listen, listen to what's being said, whether by the guests in studio or by the guests on the telephone.
Yeah, true.
And I hear a lot of talkers who barely listen at all.
Mm-hmm.
And are processing very quickly just to kind of get through the thing. And keep it hustling and keep it hyperactive.
I object to that same thing in a restaurant or anywhere else where I'm treated as a number instead of a person.
Mm-hmm. Or in a hospital, say.
Correct, right.
Yeah.
Well, hospitals are funny because they use the wrong pronouns. The doctor comes in on his morning run and says, how are we feeling this morning?
Yes,
you're
of course.
In terrible agony, and he's great. But it's always, how are we feeling? I always want to say to him, we're a little worried about our bill.
Or we're a little worried about the adequacy of our physician.
And the visitors, too. They're wonderful. They don't know what to say. They want to make you feel good. They say, gee, you got a lot of color. It's green, but it's color. Or then it's, gosh, would I trade places with you? Oh, Beth is driving me crazy, and my kids, and this daughter in college, is running around with you. They want to give you all this trouble. Yeah. They think, I suppose, by that, it'll lift your burden from you. Mm-hmm. But it does. It just compounds your own problem.
Walter Richard Aloysius Phillips, my guest. When did all of that become Wally?
As soon as I could get rid of it, really. I looked at my name when I was old enough to comprehend it. I thought, what is this? And then I learned my mother had that wonderful thought about names of her sons and daughters spelling words, W-R-A-P. And I thought, that's nice, Mom, I love you, but that's got to go.
Well, Walter handles itself rather well as it is diminutified into Wally, but Milton turns into Milty, and that doesn't work too well.
Yeah, well, I don't like either of them. In fact, they both have been on the way out for years. I would name a kid Walter or Milt today. They're both gone at 1930.
Well, you've got an interest, and indeed it's reflected in a chapter in this book, or a portion of one of the chapters, in fashions in names and the names that mm-hmm. rise and fall.
Right.
Does one discern any general social laws that explain what happens?
I think one is subject to the influence of the media today, just like it has been before, whereas women 30s and 40s gave their children names they got from movie stars. Today, television has a big influence. The name Heather came off one of the daytime drama shows like General Hospital or something, and Heather is becoming mm-hmm. very popular for girl babies. And Monica, also from a daytime show.
Monica's a good moniker.
Right. Moniker. Yeah. Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
But any event, the songs like Donovan, it's Jennifer Juniper, and uh-huh. Jennifer from Love Story are big reasons, I'm sure, why Jennifer is the number one name today.
There was a time in my tribe when they used to name people, take male names, they used to name young Jewish children for famous English aristocratic families. Thus, Milton, Irving, Sidney.
Mm-hmm. Chaucer. I had a fellow named Chaucer.
Did you?
Rosenberg, right.
I haven't met him. Then later on, they turned to other weird names like Mark and Bruce and whatever. But then the fashion changed just about the time we got into the child-making business to go back to the Old Testament.
I knew a Johnson, but he wrote like the Dickens.
He did?
Yeah, really. Dickens.
That was Thackeray in disguise, I think, as a matter of fact.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Just fooling around. That mind was so quick. For any one thought you might have, he'd have four or five free associations, which you could turn into rapid wit. A fascinating figure and a great friend, but not a very outgoing person, rather private in many ways. But everyone around here had not merely great regard for his talent, but great respect for the person. We will hear from some famous people and some, the opposite isn't infamous, but some people less famous because they're scholars or reporters or what have you, but all of them extremely interesting, I think, and directly on to a discussion about linguistics and how kids learn language. Just a little clip from a great program some years ago with three of the leading people at the American Linguistics Association.
I've been having conversations for the last three and almost a half years with my first grandchild. Well, actually, the conversations didn't really begin until he was about a year and a half old, I think. But it's been very interesting to watch language develop. To be sure, it developed in his father, who is my son, mm-hmm. but somehow I don't remember it as clearly, and I wasn't as much of a focused observer as I have been with my grandson. It is very interesting to observe the stages. I had read about this before, and indeed, the observations are correct. They begin, of course, first they begin by naming, by accidentally getting a few syllables out, which sound like human words. Mama and Dada are the ones that people first get excited about and reinforce, and I suppose somehow a kid learns pretty quickly that when he utters Mama, that means Mama.
Well, and it's a positive reaction.
Yeah, they get the positive reaction.
Yeah.
But, of course, what happens with that first word, although it means mama, it also gets extended considerably mm-hmm. beyond mama. So it may be all adults.
Or all good things.
Yeah. or all good things.
Or all sources of reinforcement.
And it may be used to give a command, to name an object,
yeah.
and so forth.
But what happens from there on with regard to the real acquisition of language? What are the stages? Supposedly they're invariant.
Mm-hmm.
What are they, that the stages that kids go through as they acquire language?
Well, certainly the from naming. I think one of the things, though, that's very interesting that may not fit specifically within the definition of language, but you mentioned the fact that your grandchild is learning the patterns of communication. So actually the conversational patterns are being learned even before words are being uttered, because mm-hmm. turn-taking and those kinds of things are communication patterns that you're developing in the child even before the first word. They learn a lot about how to use language before they actually use the first word. But using the naming, using single word commands and names and so on to get what they want, and then to begin to put words together. And two word utterances would be the next stage after one word.
Two word utterances usually lack verbs, is that right?
Well, they don't necessarily lack verbs. What they do is they tend not to use what we sometimes refer to as function words, you know. So articles and things like that. So a child may say, "Mama ball," for
yeah.
"Mommy give me the ball," or "Mama take," you know, which would be a verb and a noun together. The idea, it comes across fairly telegraphic, but what it really is. Very efficient in terms of the capability of what they can organize at that point, and then they sort of go into this two-word stage, and then, as I'm sure you notice from your grandchild, they then have this grand explosion where they almost mm-hmm. they have 12 or 14 words, and they put them together in two various two-word constructions and so forth, and then all of a sudden they explode, and within this rapid, you know, anywhere from 18 to 24 months, you just see their vocabulary expanding incredibly rapidly, and constructions coming in, and you're amazed at how these children can learn that much mm-hmm. in that short of time. But in a sense, what they're doing is they're realizing this amazing capacity that is part of the human mind in terms of our capability.
That's a brief excerpt from a conversation, all of which is available on the front page of our website. The people involved were the president, the past president, and the president-elect of the American Linguistics Society, which was meeting in Chicago at that particular time, January of the year 2000. By name, they are Walt Wolfram, Mark Arnott, and Donna Christian, from professors at various universities elsewhere. Anything that you're hearing tonight, you can get the whole thing, as I say, by just going to the front webpage. And how do you get there? It is quite simple and direct, wgnradio.com/extension720. wgnradio.com/extension720. We're going on next to a classic conversation with Carl Sagan. But first, these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We're not kidding ourselves. Tonight we know that the Academy Awards are on. Therefore, probably some of our regular listeners or our occasional listeners are now following the occasion over there in Hollywood. All the same, for those who are with us, we're very glad you're there. And as we go through these various excerpts from classic Extension 720 programs, all drawn directly from the front page of the website for the program. As we go through all of them, we'll entertain calls, not merely for the last half hour or whatever, but get some calls in if you're so moved, and we might take a few quickies in between the excerpts. The phone number, of course, is the same as it has ever been, 312-591-7200. 591-7200, area code 312. Carl Sagan. I met Carl Sagan on this program. That is when he came to do it. Only about 2 years into my tenure with the program, and we discovered that we were from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn and indeed had gone to the same what used to be called junior high school. These days, I guess they call the middle schools. But over the years, we became, I think, rather good friends, not merely doing radio programs, but having other contacts as well. And here then is Carl, towards the end of his career, I fear. He died too young, and that was a great loss. But here we are talking in December of 1994, drawing upon his then recently published book, A Pale Blue Dot. That's a reference to the Earth as seen from the moon or elsewhere. Carl Sagan.
I think of the discovery of the so-called New World and the settlement of the New World, which was done at a very high cost to the residents of the New World and produced tremendous culture conflict, which indeed led to millions and millions of deaths. You've long been interested in extraterrestrial life, and you've been much involved in mounting the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, and I know that you're personally convinced that there's likely to be a good deal of life out there elsewhere. Inevitably, if we are going to be settling planets in other solar systems than our own, there would seem to be a high probability that we're going to be doing what the Spaniards and the Dutch and the others did when they came into the Western Hemisphere. We're going to be imposing ourselves upon other, we can't say peoples, but upon other beings, and there might be hell to pay in consequence. One has to ask about the consequences of this sort of migration, which might generate interspecies conflict.
Okay, so
do we run into extraterrestrials who are going to be unhappy to find us dropping in on them?
Let's go step by step. First off, as far as we've been able to find so far, this solar system is lifeless.
Mm-hmm.
If it were not, if there were even microbial life somewhere, then that would change my view. But in a lifeless solar system, all of the motivations that applied to Christopher Columbus and his colleagues don't apply. There's no gold, there's no spices, there's no slaves to capture and bring back, there are no heathen to convert, and so all of those mainly egregious motives that led to so much pain and suffering don't apply.
So as Woody Guthrie sang, this land is your land, this land is my land, we can say, this solar system is your land, this solar system is my land.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of owning a planet seems ludicrous to me.
But
it depends what you mean by mine. But at least
it's where
we can
live.
We can
it's where
that's
we
right.
live.
That's right.
But beyond the solar system.
Okay. So now, first of all, let's remember beyond the solar system is quite far in our technological future.
But you're estimating 400 to 600 years, aren't you?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But of course, we will in that time have made a very thorough SETI search to see if there is anyone out there. And in SETI, the most likely circumstance by far is that we get a message from someone much more advanced than we.
Mm-hmm.
Not much less, because anybody dumber than us doesn't even have radio, since we've just invented radio. So the scenario is much more to worry about what they'll do to us than what we'll do to them. And as far as the receipt of a radio message goes, that's perfectly safe. The transmitting civilization has no way to know that we even got the message.
We don't have to signal back.
We do. Nothing requires us to answer. Yeah. The trouble is that radar and television have already signaled our presence.
Sure.
And so there's a spherical wave expanding out at the speed of light from the Earth that indicates the presence of a rudimentary technical civilization. It contains the television programs of the late 40s. Milton Berle, Howdy Doody, the Army McCarthy hearings, and other signs of high intelligence.
How far have they reached at the moment?
About 45 light years.
Yeah.
So if there's any extraterrestrial civilization within 45 light years, then they have just discovered our presence.
What a thought. They're watching the Army McCarthy hearings.
Yeah. And so, as I sometimes say when I'm asked, if there are smart beings out there, how come they're not here? Now you know. It's a sign of their intelligence. They don't come here. I just mean that as a joke.
Yeah.
So the idea that a very slow and cautious movement of humans out beyond the solar system is going to give us grief is belied by the fact that expanding at the speed of light, far ahead of any flotilla of spacecraft from the Earth, is our radio transmission.
Yeah.
So, and that's what's going to dominate our relationships with other beings.
Through the miracle of modern electronics and modern internet technology, we get our IT guy, in fact, produces every month the actual numbers of how many downloads have occurred for each of the podcasts up on the website. And by far, this one with Carl Sagan and the next one coming up after we pause for some news with Henry Kissinger are two of the most popular. They continue to be downloaded by all sorts of people as they discover the site, I suppose. And thus we have kept them up for some time rather than rotated them through. There are many others that I want to put up on the front page. They are on the back pages at the moment. You can find them if you link and just go to the back pages. But there are many others that I want to get up on the front pages. And they will have to be that will displace some other entries that are presently there. But these two, the one with Sagan and with Kissinger, and one or two others, were keeping up over the long haul simply because people remain very, very interested in hearing them. There's one missing one. I mean to talk about that in a little bit later tonight. I can't find, we cannot find, the tape for the night that Margaret Thatcher was on this program, and it is nowhere in the station files. And I would be delighted if any one of our listeners who happened to record it originally, and we know that lots of people have done that with this program over the years, would get in touch. And we'd be very, very pleased to receive a copy. But that's another matter. Right now, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And as previously indicated, we go now to Henry Kissinger. These are two excerpts which we'll play in a row, and they are from the full program that you find on the front page of our website. Again, the way to get to the website, and you will certainly want to hear all of this conversation once you get a taste of it. the website address or location, wgnradio.com/extension720. That's simple. This is a conversation, I think it's the second or third that we had with Kissinger, and it is from the year 2001, and it will explain itself as we begin.
My colleague at the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, did an article, 1991, thereabouts, I believe in Atlantic, in which he said, we are going to miss the Cold War. This was after the collapse of the communist regimes of Eastern Europe and after, I think, the dismantlement of the Soviet Union. His point was, of course, that great polarity was, in a way, a stabilizing sort of tension. But once it was withdrawn, who knew what new devils would emerge? Was he right?
He had a point, especially for the United States. I mean, we are an unusual country. We are the only major country that has never had a powerful neighbor. We are the only major country that really could make itself believe that whether we participated in international affairs or not depended on us. And we're the only major country that believed that we could solve problems in definite time frames. So as long as the Soviet Union was around, we had a clear-cut danger. It ended the dispute whether we should be engaged or shouldn't be engaged. It also ended the dispute about should there be a time limit to our effort. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we are in a world for which our historical experience prepares us less, but which has all kinds of flashpoints around it, and which, moreover, is more interconnected than the world has ever been. And that is a subtle and complex challenge for America.
In this book, you address, not for the first time, when I say this book, I refer, of course, to the new volume, Does America Need a Foreign Policy? That volume by Henry Kissinger, just recently published by Simon & Schuster. And you address, as I say, not for the first time, the question of whether the Wilsonian doctrine of intervention in the world in general pursuit of the values of democracy and in general opposition to modes of inhumane treatment of populations by despots, that this Wilsonian doctrine, earlier condemned by George Kennan, remains a great temptation, was in some sense revived by President Clinton during his 8 years in office,
yes,
but is really a dreadful lure to which we should not be attracted.
This is correct up to a point. The United States, being the nation it is, will always stand for democracy, humane values, and human rights. The question is, how far do we go in defense of these?
The question is, do we put our military forces in hazard in defense of those rights?
That is the key issue. And also, how do we relate it to other issues in the world? For example, we were very active in overthrowing the government in Indonesia. We didn't overthrow it directly, but we made a series of conditions as for economic aid, which had the practical consequence of overthrowing the military government, which was surely not democratic. But one of the results of doing this without having a clear alternative in mind is an extraordinarily chaotic situation in which corruption is still existent. The country is falling apart.
The president's about to be impeached,
The president is in the process of being impeached. And so, therefore, the United States, there is a limit to what the United States can accomplish. We intervened in Kosovo militarily, which I opposed before we did it and supported once we were engaged. But as a result, we now face we are faced with a situation in which the Kosovo will attempt to make itself independent. We become an occupying force. If Kosovo becomes an independent state, the same situation will arise in Macedonia that had existed in Kosovo. Most Americans barely know where that place is, and therefore we are getting into an increasingly complex situation. And my basic view is when one risks American lives, one must be in a position to explain to the mothers what the American interest was in doing that.
And another excerpt from the very same conversation, and I will repeat what I said earlier. We're certainly interested in your responses to what you're hearing. If you want to make a quick response via the telephone or ask a brief question, do by all means get in there at 312-591-7200. We'll take such calls as they come in between the excerpts, which will run on through for the full two-hour program. But here again, a little bit later in that same conversation with Henry Kissinger.
There are those who suggest that the country we are really worried about with regard to a potential nuclear assault is China, which, to be sure, doesn't have a nuclear force equal to that of England or France, let alone of the United States. But they seem to be committing a good deal of scientific effort, if not of, and probably also of their capital, into building a missile force. And they seem to have, one way or another, got their hands on a good deal of American technology to speed them along.
The latter is probably true. My understanding is that the Chinese right now have between 30 and 50 missiles, and with single warheads, so it would take them 10 to 15 years to to get any respectable size. Mm-hmm. I don't think the danger from China is a nuclear attack on the United States. It's uncharacteristic. This is a society that has existed for 5,000 years. They defeat their enemies not by a massive, sudden assault, but by endurance, but by outlasting them. So if we get into conflict with China, it is much more likely to be because China, as its strength grows, will insist on being treated by its neighbors with respect and deference, and that gradually this will create a situation where we believe that that hegemony of China over Asia is unacceptable to us, as it should be. It should be unacceptable to us, the hegemony of any country, and that would lead to a conflict. But I do not believe a conflict that China would ever conceive an all-out attack on the United States. They've never done that in their history, conduct wars that way, and it is so against their national character, and it's so improbable that I do not believe that this is likely.
Is it equally improbable that they will not develop the intention of that Japan had? Japan wanted to create what, at the time of the beginning of World War II, they called the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity
Sphere. No, that
sphere.
They could develop.
Do they want to have economic dominance and sort of programmatic dominance over Asia?
Well, the Chinese are a Confucian society, and therefore they believe in hierarchy, and therefore they believe that there usually has to be a ruler, and so it would be not unnatural for them to believe that if their achievements deserve it, as they may, that they should have a dominant position in Asia. If they attempt it, however, they will not find that all that easy, because they have powerful neighbors. They have India. They have Russia,
which has crossed the billion mark in population, I believe.
The likelihood is that Indian population will exceed that of China. The question is, can they organize it effectively? But India, in fact, has the technology and the educational background and the civil service to evolve on paper more rapidly than China. Unfortunately, they have a bureaucracy left by England and trained at the London School of Economics, that it's the last socialist bastion. So it is not, their state system they get very little foreign investment. They should be getting a lot more. But at any rate, they'll run up against India, they'll run up against Japan, and they'll run up against us. It is certainly the growing power of China, it's something we should think about. But it is not something we should deal with the same way we dealt with the Soviet Union.
He is still writing op-ed pieces. I understand that he's still got another book in the works. The man now is over 90, I do believe. A most exceptional presence in the modern history of the United States and of the American government. Henry Kissinger. The full conversation, as I say, can be heard directly if you go to our web page, that being wgnradio.com/extension720. And with that, we'll pause briefly with an interesting surprise coming directly after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
This program, Extension 720, has been around for a long time, as regular listeners know. And we have used loads and loads of guests who are touring around promoting books. But, of course, we also use loads and loads of local guests. Occasionally, not infrequently, in fact, a local figure of prominence or a local figure emerging from the dusks of anonymity does a great book or a good book or an amusing book. Somebody you can always count on to produce a good and always amusing book is Joseph Epstein. As a matter of fact, only this very day on this station, Mike McConnell interviewed Joe Epstein to discuss a book that Joe Epstein discussed with us in a full two-hour program, his book about gossip. That's his current volume. A few years ago, he did a book on snobbery, and we're about to hear an excerpt from that. In this discussion, we were joined with another good friend, John Anderson, who used to be one of the main features writers at the Tribune. He went on to doing other things a few years ago. But here, then, Joe Epstein and John Anderson, who has hobnobbed with some of the snob circles of Chicago and of the North Shore, and I discuss some aspects of the art, or is it the perversion of snobbery?
I had a most interesting encounter today at lunch, and I wanted to tell you about it. A little luncheon today given by the French Consul General at the Everest Room, and I was chatting with Hackworth, the British CG, about a matter on which he thought I might be able to advise him, when I noticed some people sitting down the table fiddling with their escargot, not able to master the special tongs that one uses with escargot. Well, first, you know, to get the thing in the tongs, and then to carry it en direction de bouche, as they say. I had to hurry away for a board meeting, but on the way out, I noted to my friend Jean Joho, the chef, that the young fellow from the New York Times Bureau especially was having particular difficulty. And Jean whispered, "Ah, les pauvres jeunes, ils sont amusants, non?" And I couldn't resist saying to him, he being something of a scholar, and who knows the literature, I said, "Bien sûr, mon vieux, c'est comme La Rochefoucauld nous a dit, dans l'adversité de nos meilleurs amis, nous trouvons quelque chose qui ne nous déplaît pas." He agreed, and so I rushed downstairs, I rushed down on the elevator. You've seen that elevator, probably, rather overdone with polished bronze. And Ernesto, my driver, was, as usual, right on the spot waiting for me. But enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think of my little tale, John?
It's, first of all, I thought this was an American show. You're going to go right off into Yiddish if we don't control you in a moment. There's so many languages.
But isn't that the way, wasn't that a great way to put people down, to use a language without translating?
Absolutely.
In writing, certainly. Also.
Absolutely. It's a tricky question. There's one of the first questions about snobbery, first distinction that has to be made, I think, is the distinction between the snob and the elitist. If I may say so, my dear friend Milton, you were an unmediated, immitigable elitist.
Without a snob bone in my body.
You may have some little edges and touches of snobbery, too, but I think you would set up as an elitist, someone who claims, "I simply am interested in the very best and let everyone else go hang." And the distinction is the snob really feels that way, I mean the elitist, whereas the snob is concerned with the best, but also people have to know he's enjoying the best or doing the best or...
Well, that's what this little piece I worked up was about.
Exactly, of course, of course.
Did you catch the business about the overdone elevator?
Yes, I picked up on that. Your French is too fast for me. I require subtitles.
Well, you quote La Rochefoucauld in your book.
That's right.
Dans l'adversité de nos meilleurs amis, nous trouvons quelque chose qui ne nous déplaît pas. Exactly. In the misfortunes of our friends, we find something
certain pleasure
that is not totally displeasing.
Exactly. Schadenfreude, it's Schadenfreude in the 18th century.
Yeah, I think there's just a bias that as soon as you lapse into French, French, you're going up to another plateau.
You're one up.
I belong to a book club in Rogers Park, and we just struggled. Mary and Eric and Steve and me through Marcel Proust. It took us a year and a half to read Marcel Proust, meeting every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then I ran into Leon Dupré at some event, and he said, "Oh, yes, I've reread Proust in French."
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, that just boggles the mind that somebody be able to even do that.
But is it, with all due honor to Leon Dupré, a very important figure in the history of Chicago, to add in French, isn't that a touch of a snob put down?
I would say so. I think one of the things a snob likes to do is encourage a sense of hopelessness in the next person. And he seems to succeed in
another
friend,
last Saturday night, I was at a banquet at the International Ballroom of the Conrad Hilton. There were 1,000 people, all being served at once. Mm-hmm. And I remember being in a similar banquet with the French Consul General, mm-hmm. who looked out across the room and he said, "You know, an evening like this is a wonderful thing. You know, it's not a meal, but it's a technical achievement."
Interesting, you mentioned Marcel Proust. Marcel Proust has done a blurb for this book.
Yes.
He says, "Mr. Epstein quotes me rather frequently in his faintly amusing little book. Whether he understands me is, of course, another question entirely, one I haven't the space to dilate upon here. I've never been to America, so I cannot speak to the accuracy of his pronouncements about the particulars of the social preoccupations in that faraway country. The book's theoretical framework, so to speak, seems to be sound as far as it goes, though I suppose to say this suggests that it ought to have gone a deal further. But then in these matters, who of us can be said to have gone far enough?" Wonderful.
Thank you. Of course, Proust just took 3 million words to talk about snobbery, didn't he? The other blurbs, I'm so pleased you
I love the Noel Coward. You want to read that one?
Well, the Noel Coward says about my book, "Like most artists of the past 100 years, myself not least among them, Joseph Epstein's origins are in the lower middle class, that class always eager to get a leg up, if only to be able to place an ill-shod foot on the neck of those below and a knee in the groin of those above."
I always have tremendous pleasure talking with Joe Epstein, whether it's about his latest book, and he's been doing virtually all of the vices, from snobbery to gossip, etc. He's done a number of others as well. He is, at the same time, a great essayist. We've done one or two programs with him directly focused on literary things, including a program on the personal essay. And he is also a wonderful short story writer. His short stories appear regularly in various magazines, most particularly in the monthly publication Commentary. The next one up, I want to get to it quickly so we fit it in between and hit the newscast more or less on time, is with Oliver Sacks, that great neurologist is what he is in medical terms, but also a great literary figure, I would say. And all of his books have dealt with cases he's encountered. His book, Awakenings, which must be known to many of our listeners, is based upon a group who were on back wards in a hospital in New York and had been essentially somnolent and out of any contact with anything or anybody for 20 or 30 years. They all suffered from encephalitis lethargica, commonly known as sleeping sickness. And a new drug that came along made it possible to awaken them, though as unhappily the awakening was only temporary. There's a wonderful film that was based on this very book. Here's our conversation about one of those cases with Oliver Sacks.
Let us turn directly to awakenings. Indeed, some of the cases that you've got in the book and which were also chosen by Arnie April, the adapter and director of the theatrical version for representation in that play. I know that Rose R. is one of them, and she was one of my favorites in the book as well.
Rose R. was certainly one of the strangest, and she was also the patient who inspired Harold Pinter to mm-hmm. his play. A New York socialite, she was a very bright, energetic woman, sort of full of life.
One thinks of her as Rosie rather than...
Yeah, absolutely, Rosie. She had a very, very intense life until she was 21, when she had a very virulent attack of the encephalitis. With hers, with a lot of patients, it's very strange how patients can dream of an illness. There seem to be premonitory dreams, although I think probably what happens is that the illness is presenting in sleep. So she dreamt that she had become a statue. She dreamt that she'd been bewitched. She dreamt that she was in some strange state which was dead, but not dead.
Mm-hmm.
And when she woke the next morning, her family could see that something grotesque had happened to her, and so could she when she looked in the mirror. The local doctor thought this was catatonia, some sort of catatonic reaction, maybe to a broken heart, mm-hmm. and said, don't worry, she'll look after her, she'll be okay in a week. But she didn't recover in a week, or a year, or 43 years. She sunk into this strange catatonic state, this trance-like state. She was looked after at home at first, and then it became too difficult, and she moved into hospital. She moved into Mount Carmel in 1935. I saw her 31 years later and saw someone who still looked rather youthful. She was 61, but she looked a lot younger, and who had been held in the strange bewitchment for 30 years. One had an extreme feeling of her being elsewhere and not quite in the world. Mm-hmm. It made me rather hesitant about giving the L-DOPA.
I suddenly have the rather banal thought, as a kind of simile, this is like the Sleeping Beauty. She is the Sleeping Beauty, the princess, and you are, with your L-DOPA, the Prince Charming, was he, or what, some kind of prince, who leans over and kisses her and brings her back to consciousness.
Well, one did very much have the feeling of being almost in a land of fable,
yeah.
So certainly at the intersection of fact and fable. I used to love myths and legends and fables when I was a kid, and a lot of them seemed to be realized here. One saw people who had been turned into stone, and indeed one then saw sort of statues who came to life.
And she is a statue who came to life, and she came awake. And what were the consequences?
Like almost all of the patients, the initial consequences were wonderful. The rigidity disappeared. She became able to move freely. She became able to talk. A feeling of life rushed through her. And there was first a tremendous delight in being alive again, enjoying the world, the air, other people, being resurrected. One of the patients half-jokingly called dopamine resurrectamine.
Yeah.
And the feeling in summer of 69 was really one of rebirth and resurrection. This then moved very rather rapidly into a strange state in which she used language and gestures like someone out of the 1920s. She used, she had argot, which had become obsolete.
She was a flapper.
And she was a sort of flapper who had come to life. I didn't quite know where she was then. Was she confused? And I asked her. She was a very bright woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, look, she said, I can tell you the date of Pearl Harbor. I can tell you the date of Kennedy's assassination. I've registered it all, but nothing seems real. She said, I've been a spectator for the last 43 years. She also said that she didn't like our world, our television world, too much. That everyone she knew, and people who had mattered to her, the world which had mattered so much to her, felt had vanished. She wasn't absolutely crazy about being awakened. Now, whether this was the determining thing or whether it was something physiological, I don't know. But after a week or 10 days of this strange, anachronistic animation in which she seemed to be, in a way, still back in the 20s, she suddenly reverted to her trance-like state. Became unable to move or speak again, and never really moved or spoke again, although she lived another 10 years. And so there was just this brief glimpse of a very paradoxical awakening.
The window was open for just
the
flip of a second, really.
Yeah, and she
That's
didn't
so
she
sad.
Did she didn't like what she saw through it. This was very much the saddest. On the whole, the stories were sort of much happier, and in a way, amazingly happy.
Dr. Sachs's adventures in neurology, as he recounts them with a tremendous human sensitivity, are always gripping and always illuminating. This is a wonderful discussion, and you can hear all of it, as I say, if you just go to the front page of our website, wgnradio.com/extension720. We go now to the newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And here now is something quite special. This is not at the moment on the front page of our website. Indeed, it's not yet on the website at all, but it has been located elsewhere on a separate page, which I won't bother to explain. But we are, in fact, moving this one to the website for the program at WGNradio.com/extension720. This is the great English actor, playwright, political commentator, ultimately university president or the warden of a great university in England, the University of Durham, Peter Ustinov, Sir Peter Ustinov. And it is a compound from two separate visits that he made to the program, in which, on my invitation and on my suggestion, he undertook to play two roles. I told him to be a Southern senator. I gave him the name, and to be also an East Indian politician. And all the rest was his invention, just superb. Here it is.
A few years ago, indeed, as we launched our national program, The American Leader, we were joined by three gentlemen of diverse background, but of complementary and convergent interest. That is, they were all knowledgeable in the public affairs, the politics of each other's nations. And here is a brief excerpt from that conversation.
An unusual and happy circumstance. Two congressmen have joined us. They've both done their memoirs. One is P.J. Wertenbaker III, who's now in his 14th term as representative from the 22nd Congressional District of Alabama, and who is the author of the recently published book, A Congressman Remembers. Our other guest is a bit more exotic, namely Sohan Ramanathanan Halabalu, who is a member of, indeed a leading official of, the Congress Party in India, and has just had published a book titled Memoirs of a Congressman. So we have Memoirs of a Congressman and A Congressman Remembers. Gentlemen, it's very fortunate to have the two of you with us, and I would fain hear some discourse tween ye twain. Congressman Wertenbaker, to begin.
Well, I don't know this gentleman. Are you from a reservation, sir? What do you mean? I'm from the Congress Party. There is no Congress Party, sir. Well, in India, there is one.
Oh, you're from India, India?
You don't have to say it twice in order to make your meaning clear. I'm in the Congress Party, very, very efficient member of the Congress Party. I've been for a very long time. And we are inaugurating some new laws which are entirely different, as it were. As it were, from any other that have been brought in the very immediate past.
Well, I'd like some equal time here. I'm here to exploit a book that I've just written. You doing the same thing, sir?
Yes, I am indeed. It's just been translated from the Urdu. And it's translated already into several other languages. And I want to make that quite clear.
All right, sir. I don't have a hearing problem, sir. You can talk softly to me. It's very interesting for us to know other points of view in other parts of the world. I personally have little experience outside this country, this great country of ours. That's why I'm an effective congressman of the 22nd District, as has been pointed out by our anchorman host. Now, I don't know what you call them up here. We have several names for them. I can't follow your reasoning, I'm afraid. We don't have such people in India. We do it all ourselves. Our is a do-it-yourself country. We don't receive any help for what we do. That's what you don't seem to understand over here. Everything is done for you. We are very close to the soil. And hello? Oh, I think somebody's coming. So take the weight off us.
Yes, somebody is indeed coming, an old friend. And he's been listening to the two of you in this rather surprising discourse. Sir Peter Ustinov, the celebrated actor, writer, director, or is he writer, director, actor, or are his plays tragical, comical, pastoral, or pastoral, comical, historical?
Oh, I'm not a great one for labels, and that's why I'm not a member of either the party in Congress or the Congress Party. How do you do, gentlemen?
Hello, how are you? I'm fine. I wasn't talking to you.
And now, by a wonderful set of circumstances, I really, by virtue of the meeting of the American Booksellers Association in Chicago, those very same three gentlemen are with us once again. We've been able to persuade all three of them to take time out from their very busy schedules to join us in the studio. So here, once again, are Congressman P.J. Wertenbaker and also Mr. Rajanathanan Halabalu, and, of course, Sir Peter Ustinov. And again, they've written books. Congressman Wertenbaker, your new book is The Capital with Interest.
Yes, that's right. I, of course, I've aged considerably since the last time I was here. But I came up from Mobile today in order to try and exploit this book, which seems to me only a sensible way of approaching the new contract with America, which I personally refused to sign.
Well, we certainly want to hear your views on that and why you have refused to sign it. And, Mr. Halabalu, I note that your new volume just published is titled Gandhi, Nehru, Krishnamenon, and Me.
No, well, of course, that was the publisher's idea. But the original title was Me, Krishnamenon, Gandhi, and a few others. That was the original title. But, of course, you can't rely on the publishers in India these days because anything happens with the... Unfortunately, Congress Party knew a considerable defeat in where I come from, which is Open Door. Open Door is a very liberal society in India. And I'm giving my time more to philanthropic things these days. I'm still a member of the Congress, but not of the Congress Party, but of the Rising Sun Party. Urugo Koriya Manodoi, in our particular usage.
Is that in Urdu or in Hindi?
No, that's not in Urdu, you see. Everything has changed in India for the better, actually for the worse, but it's changed anyway. Let's put it that way. And we are now no longer using all the usages which we usually did. I'm now manufacturing various Japanese imports under license, and I have stopped. And I categorically wish this to be known. I've stopped employing child labor in my carpet factory.
You both, of course, remember Sir Peter Ustinov. And, Sir Peter, you are a frequent visitor to the countries represented by our two other guests. Surely you are a frequent visitor to this country. And you've been, I'm sure, many times in India as well, have you not?
Yes, indeed I have. And I respect everybody here at the table very much. I had the pleasure of meeting them a long time ago now. Senator Wertenbaker, you look remarkably hale for your very advanced years.
Why is that? You have to speak a little louder. I didn't have this problem last time I was on there, but now I have to lip read as much anything. For that, I need my contact lenses.
And, of course, Mr. Halabalu has probably been your host in Delhi when the last time you were there, was he?
Yes, yes. A very powerful meal. I remember, which had me gasping for breath. But I felt myself very eloquent afterwards, because it forces you to speak a great deal in order to liberate your throat from the spices.
Three significant nations of the world are represented at this table: the United States, India, and, of course, the United Kingdom. And I'm most interested in the impressions that each of you has of the other two nations. Perhaps Mr. Halabalu, to begin with.
Well, of course, we flatter ourselves that we are the real harbingers, as it were, of British culture, because since the British Raj has left, they have changed considerably. It's now an ill-tempered little nation which is harping the whole time about the royal family and doing other very excessive things. We are the only one who have still got the dignity. The dignity and the distance between us and events, which we are the true guardians of the English spirit as it was left to us. That is my opinion. As for America, well, we have a lot of very important Indians working in your country, and we are very proud of the fact that they hold up their heads in the society which swirls around them, as it were, everything. And I feel very strongly about it, as it were.
Well, Congressman Wertenbaker, I wonder whether the Indian invasion, which some have called it, has in fact reached Mobile, Alabama, and other places in your district.
No, you know, we're a little backwater of pure Americana, if I can coin a phrase of that nature. I know Mrs. Wortenbaker spends a lot of time trying to understand the various people that have now our neighbors in our part of the world, and we try to make them very welcome. Now, we haven't seen much of the British since they left, and I was too young at the time to remember exactly the details of that. But I remember my dad telling me about the British leaving, and you know, with a fife drum and dropping tea in the harbor and all that. It was in style in those days. And with the Indians, I got it wrong at first. I thought it was the Cherokees, who are a personal friend of mine. We made it up at long last. Yeah, we're good friends of the Cherokee and the Seminoles. There are very few Seminoles left in that part of the world. There are no whole Noles at all, just a few Seminoles. And they're doing all right. They're doing fine. They're a very talented lot of people. So I believe it's one world. We have to change our manner, and we have to be accommodating. That's a word I like to use a lot these days.
Well, what both of you have to say is both interesting and heartening, and I'm sure that, Sir Peter, you must feel a sense of pleasure.
Yes, I am, and I haven't been able to get a word in edgewise, but...
I've noticed that.
I didn't want it, really, because I found it too interesting to learn about things that one doesn't really know about. I didn't know the way these people would brush off against each other. But they're both very charming. I see that it must be jet lag, because Mr. Hullabaloo seems... I don't want to wake him.
Well, perhaps we'd better pause and have a restful moment of commercials. And then we'll be directly back to Sir Peter Ustinov and his two other friends. And we return now to our three friends compacted, in fact, in one, Sir Peter Ustinov, who is, of course, as close to what is called a Renaissance man, that's a cliche, I would say a universal man, in the arts and indeed in intellectual life. I am, as an old university hand myself, delighted to discover that you are the Chancellor, is it? Of Durham,
yes, that's right.
Durham University.
Yeah. That's in the north of England,
mm-hmm.
with a cathedral which was begun in 1088, I think. So William the Conqueror must have brought the plans with him, I think. Awfully soon after he arrived.
Those two other fellows who were with us earlier, I believe Congressman Wortenbaker is dozing now as well as Mr. Hullabaloo.
Yes, they're both, yes, exactly.
They were both inventions that you and I worked out. That is, I gave you the challenge, and you rose to the challenge superbly. We first invented Senator, tonight he was Congressman, Wortenbaker, way back perhaps some 18 years ago, the first time you were on the
program. Yes, I tried to show that he'd aged.
He has indeed.
Yes, he has. Yeah. But he's still there, of course.
And Mr. Hullabaloo, was the challenge I threw you only about 2.5 years ago when you recorded the program, of which we played an excerpt at the very beginning tonight. And I think you catch not merely the intonations of English as spoken by a cultivated East Indian, but you capture something of the national character.
Well, I think the imitation is not really to do with voices.
No.
It's to do with mentality, because if you've got nothing to say in your imitation, then it doesn't really work. I remember Jack Parr suddenly saying to me, "We hear that you do a Dutchman speaking Chinese." And I just backed out of it. I said, "I have no idea what a Dutchman speaking Chinese would say." And it doesn't seem to me a very lucrative path to follow. In point of fact, you've got to know how people think in order to be able to imitate. You're really imitating a mentality as much as anything.
And it should be understood that all of that wonderful performance was pure improvisation. There was no script, and he was responding to the challenge that I put to him. That was all invention on the spot. An incredibly talented man with a very rich mind. He was also a very considerable novelist. He went to his reward only about a year ago, and I was quite sad to learn of that. Still, I think in his late 70s, or at the most his early 80s, delightful, charming, astonishingly talented, and really extremely interesting fellow, Sir Peter Ustinov. We return directly after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we've just got about 4 minutes here before we go to the news. So, a somewhat shorter one with a dear old friend and one of the most really talented, challenging, intelligent, and really entertaining people one might ever encounter, James Randi, otherwise known as The Amazing. James The Amazing Randi is, of course, a skilled magician, or a conjurer, as he would say, who has spent the second half of his career, and it still persists to this moment, showing up psychic frauds of all kinds. And here is a brief excerpt from a conversation we had with The Amazing Randi back in 1990.
You, of course, I think it was probably your first published book, The Magic of Uri Geller, in which you showed that Geller is a charlatan and a cheat, or a conjurer who won't call it conjuring.
You said that. Now he can sue you.
Well, he probably will. I know he's been trying to sue you, but has failed. Your book, The Faith Healers, deals with overt, intended fakery by people who pass themselves off as Christian clergymen.
Purposeful lying and deceit.
Purposeful lying and deceit, which also helps to rush people to earlier death than they would otherwise
have. Indeed, it does.
And you've gone at astrology, you've gone at dowsing. In general, you are, of course, you got the MacArthur Genius Award, and they give those to some 20 people a year. You got it a number of years ago for your valuable social service in showing up this kind of fraudulence and chicanery as it tends to corrupt and confuse our lives. What's the connection between all of that and the work on Nostradamus and on prophecy?
Because, you know, the whole general theme behind this is, now we have four people sitting in the studio here that are members of the local skeptical group, and I know you're well connected as well, Milton. I would say that we'd probably all agree on this general observation, I would hope. When people say to you, and as they say to me quite frequently, what harm does it do if people believe in astrology or Nostradamus? Is it really going to lead to any harm?
It's an amusement.
It's an amusement. It's a light thing. People don't really take it that serious. The astrological column in the newspaper, any editor will tell you that you can take anything out of the newspaper, but not the astrology column, or the phone goes off.
If Gene Dixon tells me that a two-headed child will be born to the wife of the prime minister of a country in the southern hemisphere sometime before the end of this century, it doesn't hurt.
No. What harm could that do? And the answer, I think, is very simple. The harm that this sort of thing does is it promotes belief in the paranormal, in the supernatural, in the occult, in absolutely illogical and irrational beliefs. And if people begin to live with those beliefs, suppose they go to an astrologer, an astrologer tells them something or other, it appears to come true, or they force it to come true in some way or another, the harm that it does is it gets them into a magical mode of thinking. And Milton, those people are going to vote, and they're going to make decisions for their children. They're going to know what school they're going to have to decide, what school to send the children to, how they're going to be educated, and by whom. And if they are thinking magically, they will go for that form of life. And that is not logical, and it is not productive. It can be very, very dangerous. They will subscribe to the faith healers and the homeopathic medicine and the chiropractic and all this sort of thing, which essentially is useless and or harmful.
How harmful? We had a president whose wife seemed to take astrology rather seriously, and consulting with a friend in San Francisco, an astrologer.
How embarrassing.
She made some important determinations about her husband's traveling schedule.
Indeed.
Did that do any harm?
And she even timed an operation according to the configuration of the planets.
And Donald Regan, who revealed it all, sat in the chair you're sitting in now and carried on about it about 2 years ago.
And you know what he told me backstage in Washington? He came over to me, grabbed me by the hand, he said, I guess I owe you a bit of an apology. He said, you've been talking about this, they tell me, for 8 years on your lecture tour. And I said, yes, and no one has believed me. And he said, and after I published it and it became news and everyone was starting to talk about it, he said, members of Congress are coming to me and saying, Donald, didn't you know? We all knew that, but we didn't dare speak about it. It was an open secret in Washington, but it hadn't gotten to his ears yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard it from many people in Washington, and I had been preaching it for 8 years.
The amazing Randy, one of the greatest guests any talk show host could possibly want, and he's been our guest many times over a long period of time, and I hope to have him here again fairly soon. Right now to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Kupfert.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Have you ever heard the name Vernon Walters, or give him his full title, Lieutenant General Vernon Walters? An exceptionally significant and important and fascinating fellow, and he undoubtedly is known to some of our listeners, but only perhaps some of the older ones. Vernon Walters ended his official career in government as the deputy director of the CIA. He served in that post from 1972 to 76. And before that, he had many diplomatic assignments. He was really a troubleshooter around the world. He actually entered the Army as a recruit, as a private, in World War II. He rose to general officer, not through West Point, but through his own great skills and his own great performance, both as a fighting soldier and as really a diplomat of tremendous skill. One of the things that enhanced his skill was that he was the ultimate polyglot. The man knew could converse easily in, I'm not sure what total number of languages, he claimed 8 or 9, and I'm told by others who knew him that he was able to do quite well in yet others beyond the 8 or 9. He did a memoir, and we talked with him in a memorable evening back in 1978, and here is a portion of that discussion.
Selecting just one occasion from your long, exciting career, let me turn your attention to that Bogota conference, 1948 in Bogota, Colombia, I think the 7th meeting of the Pan-American Congress. Our Secretary of State, General George Marshall, was down there together with a very distinguished delegation. You were attached to them as translator and I think also exercising some important intelligence functions. And the city blew up, a kind of revolutionary takeover by leftists. And indeed, they were attacking the villas in which the various delegations were staying. Apparently, the man they were gunning for more than any other was General Marshall.
Among the foreigners, yes.
But were you aware at the time of an obscure Cuban student named Fidel Castro who supposedly was in those streets carrying a machine gun?
Not before the fact, but after it was reported that he was there and one of the chief agitators. What happened, of course, was that the leader of the opposition was assassinated on the street, and people blamed the government for it and immediately rose against the government. There was very bloody fighting. There were 1,000 people killed the first day. The second day was fairly quiet. The third day, I went down to church in the morning and got caught in a terrible fusillade. And finally got back, quite happy to be back, and then I saw Averill Harriman getting ready to go out and hoped he wasn't planning on taking me, but unfortunately he was. We went down to the president's office, and there was shooting going on in the streets, and I must say he never even looked up from some economic report he was reading. We got to the president's, and he told me to bang on the door. There was no sentry in the door, and a butler opened with a Tommy gun and white tie. And Mr. Harriman, without flinching, handed him his hat. The guy fumbled with a hat and the Tommy gun. As it turned out, when we finally got to the president, he told us he'd invited 24 guests for lunch, and Mr. Harriman was the only one who had shown up.
Not many years after that, you're back in South America traveling with Vice President Nixon
right.
in Caracas, Venezuela.
Right.
I guess you're in the car when they try to kill
right.
him.
Yes. He was sitting on the right-hand side of the car with a Secret Service man on the jump seat. I was sitting on the jump seat in front of the Venezuelan foreign minister. And we had been spat upon at the airport. There were neither police nor troops there. It was a very unusual thing. There was no effort made to hold the hostile mobs away from us. Now, the United States, and this is a curious thing...
You think the Venezuelan government was trying to tell us something?
Well, they just emerged from a long dictatorship, and they didn't want to put a lot of uniforms in the street. A military dictatorship, and they didn't want to put a lot of uniforms in the street. But just about that time, the United States took some action of restricting Venezuelan petroleum imports, which caused some people there to lose their jobs, and that irritated them. And we started to ride up to Caracas, and about just short of the build-up area, there were two cars parked across the superhighway, and the central divider was so high you couldn't get across it. So we stopped, and immediately a mob came out from the woods on both sides of the road with baseball bats and iron pipes and began beating on the car. And if you've ever been inside a car with people doing this, it's like being inside a bass drum.
I'm happy to say I never have been.
Well, anyway, the Secret Service guy on the jump seat in front of Mr. Nixon pulled out his pistol and said, "Let's shoot some of these so-and-sos and get out of here." And Mr. Nixon said, "Put that away. When they open that door and drag me into the street, If I tell you, but only if I tell you, do you use it? And at that moment, I looked out of my window, and I saw a stone coming, and it hit the window, and I got a mouth and a face full of glass. And Mr. Dixon said, "Are you hurt?" And I turned around, and I said, "I don't think so." He said, "Walters, spit out that glass. I have a lot more to say to these people today." In fact, the newspapers reported that I was cut in the mouth, and one of my friends commented, "Yes, it was open, and he was talking as usual. Where else do you think he'd be injured?" Hmm. We finally got away from that. We were going to Bolivar's tomb. And I looked up this long, narrow, I believe President Carter went there the day before yesterday, at this very hostile mob, and I said to him, "Mr. Vice President, you can't go to Bolivar's tomb." And he said, "Well, do you know the city? Where can we go?" I said, "If we turn off here, we'll be off the published itinerary. And we can go to the American Embassy at the top of that hill, and they'll be out of breath when they get up there." He said, "Tell the driver to turn." And the Venezuelan foreign minister said, "But this is madness. We won't have any escort." And I was pretty fed up, and I turned around, and I said, "Mr. Minister, where is our escort?" In Spanish. And Mr. Nixon then said, "Walter, stop all this negotiating in Spanish and tell that driver to turn right." We turned right. I mean, I said to the Irvin Committee, "I can't tell you that I don't admire Mr. Nixon's courage. I do. I saw him under circumstances twice where his life was in danger, and he behaved with great courage. Which is why I find it somewhat difficult to believe these stories of him crawling on the floor of the White House and talking to the pictures. I think there's a little poetic imagination there."
That is that whole conversation. Of course, as all the others that we've played tonight, can be heard and can be downloaded, and you can get all of it, rather than just that brief excerpt, if you just go to the website for the program. The easiest way there is wgnradio.com/extension720. By the way, if you want to go to our Facebook page, and lots of people who listen to the program don't quite know that we've got a Facebook page, you get to it simply by going to Facebook/Milt Rosenberg. Facebook or Facebook.com/Milt Rosenberg. And there's room there for you to give response to any of the programs, or for that matter, to say anything else you want to get to the proprietor of the store. You can also, of course, always email us as well. The email just goes to extension720@wgnradio.com. With what we've just heard from General Walters, here is another excerpt from another well-known figure, better known, I suppose, William Sapphire, the language maven for the New York Times, and, of course, their political correspondent from Washington, and a man of considerable depth, I thought. He was on this program a number of times. Again, he died rather on the early side, but after rendering excellent service, including producing a number of fine novels. Here is a conversation with Bill Sapphire going back to 1987. The focus, again, is on Richard Nixon.
We know that Lincoln the man had a condescending view towards blacks in terms of what their potential was, what their qualities of manhood
and of
intellect
were. Yeah, he was a product of his time.
And indeed, he thought that probably the solution, once you freed the slaves, was that most of them would want to go back to Africa. In a meeting with a delegation of black leaders during the war, he said to them, in effect, "I can't understand why you wouldn't all want to get out of here once we free you."
Well, that's where I think either Lincoln was fooling some of the people or fooling himself. He had this idea. Well, he had a problem. The problem was, if he freed the slaves, which would discombobulate the South considerably and help him militarily in winning the war, if he freed the slaves, great many people in the North were worried that the slaves would come up and take Northern jobs. So he had to reassure them and assuage that fear. And in order to do it, he said, "I've got this great idea. We'll colonize them."
This is the Central America.
Yeah, they're going to send them all to Panama.
Yeah, that was a crazy one.
Now, that 3 million people he was going to send to Panama, he couldn't get 50 to agree to go. But he kept referring to this and coming back to it and all that. And I think most historians have kind of shied away from that because it shows Lincoln the devious maneuverer.
Well, you're willing to paint him with warts and all, obviously, and you've done so. Yet your estimate of him is a very high estimate, is it not?
Oh, if he were running today, I'd vote for him. Unless he were running against Washington, who's pretty good, too. I like a devious mind. I like a manipulative man. I like a politician, in other words, when he is working toward a good end. And in this case, the end he was working toward was majority rule. And
Well, you once worked for a man with a devious mind, a, and considerable mastery of the art of politics, if not of statecraft. But was he working towards a good end? What's the difference? What's the outstanding difference between the president you worked for and Abraham Lincoln, apart from the one having been booted out of the office and the other not?
Why can't you get the words Richard Nixon out of your mouth?
Richard Nixon. Richard Milhouse.
What was the question again? I kept waiting for you to say Nixon. And
you admire the deviousness of a consummate politician. Right. If he's working for noble ends, mm-hmm. does that apply to Richard Nixon as well as it does to Abraham Lincoln?
Yes, definitely. I think his aim for a generation of peace was a noble end. And I think, quite frankly, his domestic policy with his family assistance plan that's only now beginning to be reborn was pretty sound. He had some big flaws. And these were flaws that, frankly, were fanned and originated in the Alien Sedition Acts of in the early days and in the Civil War crackdown.
Yes, he sat embattled in that White House, believing and growing more and more paranoid in the belief that there was a plot really to tumble his whole government.
Listen,
virtually,
as Henry
and those
Kissinger,
kids in the streets were going to do it.
Henry always used to say, even a paranoid has some real enemies.
Yeah.
The fact was that they were demonstrating considerably, and he was trying...
They have the right to demonstration, as given in the First and other
Absolutely
amendments.
Absolutely they have a right to demonstrate. They didn't have a right to close down Washington, which is what the new mob wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I remember driving to work in a trooper in a with a bayoneted rifle on his back every 20 yards.
So when the Attorney General ordered that they all be rounded up and arrested and thrown, what was the stadium they were thrown into?
RFK Stadium. Well, it wasn't called that at the time.
Yeah, that was the holding pen. And ultimately, they were all...
I think in retrospect,
yeah.
Nixon has gotten somewhat of a bad rap from history. I think civil libertarians like me are incensed at his shortcoming. But when you read the new biography of him by Stephen Ambrose,
mm-hmm.
The first volume of which is out now, it takes a cold, hard look at those days and those times. He doesn't come out as badly as you think.
We are due for a last round of commercials and then more surprises. One that I want to be sure we get to is Anthony Bourdain, former chef who now wanders the world eating well and doing television about it. We'll be directly back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And here's one that you can, of course, hear in full on our website, but here's an excerpt with Anthony Bourdain. I think lots of people listening probably know him. He did a book which took him into the public eye, did that book, I guess, about 10 years ago, in which he just told the secrets of life in high-powered and high-energy New York restaurants, the particular set of restaurants in which he had worked, and he revealed lots of things which discomforted restaurant diners, having to do with what they did with spoiled food, having to do with what they did in the back room on potato sacks when a waitress and a waiter managed to find a spare moment or two, etc., etc. Shortly thereafter, he started a new career as a world traveler, doing travelogues focused on food and the good life all over the world. He does that very well. And he had been on the program directly after that first book appeared, and then he came back. This is only a few years ago. 2005. And he's here with a great chef in Chicago, Paul Kahan, and they're talking about the life of the chef.
What is the characterological disposition that tends to lead people into, not only into cooking, publicly and professionally, but being good chefs? Paul Kahn.
For me, I think it's I like to teach, and I like to see young people learn and grow, and that I think has been the secret to my success.
But those are good cover stories. Those are worthy.
I'm an egomaniac.
Motivations, but what?
There you go.
What's the secret pathology behind the career of a chef, Anthony Bourdain?
Listen, I think. Classically, chefs are type A personalities,
uh-huh.
control freaks, able to do many things that will multitask, people who are not easily distracted by and, in fact, addicted to Multiple problems occurring at the same time, and the solving of those
problems.
That's
running a vast kitchen.
Yeah, and even a small kitchen, there are 10 or 12 things at least you have to pay attention to. Literacy among chefs is not impressive stats. We tend to be oral and verbal, highly addictive personalities, sensualists, tactile.
Sensualist, that's interesting. Of course, food is a very sensual business in itself.
Well, I think it's our responsibility. As we're in the pleasure business, it is our responsibility as chefs, of course, to fully understand our subject of pleasure. So mm-hmm. For professional reasons, our appetites extend somewhat beyond food. I think that would be a common thread
among chefs.
That
explains something which showed up a lot in your first book, Kitchen Confidential, namely sexual adventures in the back room of the pantry on bags of potatoes and things like that.
I think, you know, just upholding a glorious tradition, you know, I travel a lot. I meet a lot of chefs from around the world. And again, I meet similar personality types. It's a very harsh business. So, you know, people who, it tends to weed out normal people through attrition very early.
How would you characterize the personality type that you meet as you talk to chefs around the world?
Pleasure-seeking sensualists who enjoy using all of their senses, mm-hmm. all the parts, both of, you know, not only their sense of taste and smell, but their ability as manipulators, managers, you know, to alter events around them to fit some kind of order. They like that mix between order and chaos.
Well, there you are, Paul. Anthony has given me a very good psychological portrait, whether correct or otherwise. Do you agree with him?
I agree for the most part. I think... I don't think that I fit that. I mean, type A personality, definitely crazy for details.
But you're not a sensualist.
I'm a sensualist, but I explore those things in other ways. I love music. I love the outdoors. Obviously, I love food. I think maybe mine is a little less X-rated, maybe because I was lucky enough to find the woman of my dreams a long time ago and have stuck with her. And, of course, my story in the book kind of relates to that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would say I live kind of hard. I run around a lot. I like to have a few cocktails or four or five after work, and I like to see what's out there and talk with people, and just like most chefs. But I think the playing around aspect is something that haven't dived into at this point.
Okay, enough on that. Now, shift to something else. Now we look at this from a business point of view, or from a culture fads and culture variability, culture change point of view. Restaurants really keep changing. That is, the fads keep changing. I came to Chicago in 1965. At that time, of course, there wasn't a Thai restaurant in Chicago. There was barely a Mexican restaurant in Chicago. Mexican came first, and there were a lot of them suddenly popped up, and some of them are still there, and they're good. Thai came later. Various things came later. Just within the last half year, or within the last year, and Paul, you're surely aware of this, there's a kind of an epidemic of Brazilian steakhouses, or Brazilian, what do you call those places?
Churrascarias.
Churrascarias.
Yeah. There are four or five of them that have opened up right in hailing distance of this radio station.
Yeah. I think it's more a response to Americans' lust for different food and better
there
food.
There you are, yeah.
In the last 20 years, I mean, you know, Chicago, the capital of science food, which I don't want to get into that.
Science food?
Science food.
I'm not sure I know what that means.
There are several really well-renowned chefs in Chicago that are...
doing their food on Bunsen burners.
Cooking over liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
Doing things with chemicals and things like that, but that's neither here nor there.
God defend me from such a restaurant. I wouldn't go to one.
Never say never. I said that before eating at El Bulli in Spain, and I...
Which is the one in Chicago that does that?
Well, there are three. There's Moto, Alinea, and a young man named Grant Elliott Bowles at the Peninsula Hotel, the restaurant there.
Uh-huh.
He does a little of the science food stuff, not as much as the other two
science
guys.
Science food.
Yeah, but I think it's Americans have really opened up to anything. I mean, you know, Charlie Trotter struggled the first 5 years that his restaurant was open in Chicago, and now it's embraced. It's full every night in, what is it, year 15, 18, 20? I don't know how long it's been open. And there are several of these temples to cuisine that people seek out, you know. So from there, they branch out to the little neighborhood places, to the ethnic places.
And Charlie Trotter has just announced recently that he's closing his restaurant in a few months. Some restaurant critics who were my guests on a program just a week or two ago said that they are attributing, they're interpreting, that it's because of his disappointment at not getting a third star from the Michelin Guide. The Michelin Guide, world-renowned evaluator of restaurants, finally evaluated the restaurants of Chicago, and everyone thought that Trotter would get the highest possible grade, 3 stars, but he only got 2. And that's enough to disappoint any man who has his aspirations and undoubtedly has his tremendous achievement because everyone who's ever been there says it is really a superb restaurant. Now, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to run a second bit with Carl Sagan. It's short. We've got time to just work it in directly. And it knocks a commercial, which you have heard on occasion on this station and on all other stations, as we approach Christmas time. Here it is.
Have you been looking for the number to call to name a star for someone this holiday season? It's a fun and unique way to symbolize your love or friendship. For just $45 plus shipping and handling, International Star Registry will name a star for anyone on your gift list. Call 800-282-3333 to name a star in the sky. You'll get the exclusive International Star Registry gift package, which includes a beautiful full-color parchment certificate inscribed in hand calligraphy and ideal for framing, plus sky charts to help you locate the star and an informative booklet about astronomy. The new star name will be copyrighted along with its telescopic coordinates in the book Your Place in the Cosmos, Volume 4, and stored in the International Star Registry's Swiss Vault. Call today to name a star. Give the gift of a lifetime for $45. 800-282-3333. International Star Registry. Call toll-free 800-282-3333. From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, you're listening to Extension 720. Once again, your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And just with regard to that last commercial, one really can't resist taking the special opportunity. The American Astronomical Society. No, who did it? Who named
the International Astronomical Union? Gets
International Astronomical Union names asteroids and other bodies out in space, and they've named asteroid 2709 Sagan. That's its official name. But this thing that we've just been hearing about, which is a commercial that's carried every year at around this time. Because it's sort of a Christmas gift, the International Star Registry, I think they call it.
Yes.
And if you pay $25, you get them to name something someplace out in space for the person that you designate. And it's in a book that they will it's in a book that they've got in a Swiss vault.
Excellent place to keep it. This is a complete scam.
One doesn't ordinarily knock commercials, but I'll probably get in great trouble on this, but I have to invite you to respond.
It's a scam. First of all, this has no official anything. It's just, if you want this company to name a star after you, then it's between you and the company. But it has nothing to do with astronomers. It has nothing to do with what people in the future will
call
stars.
But they don't claim that it does.
And not just that. Yeah. All the stars that we know of already have designations. They must, because how would astronomers refer to them if they didn't? Was no way to talk about them. So this is one of the many money-grubbing ways that emerge around Christmas time all around us.
I mentioned this to somebody who knows the people who run this outfit, and they said, yeah, well, they know all of that, and they don't promise anything that isn't true. They say they will give it a name, and they'll deposit it in their Swiss bank vault.
But there is an implication that it's much more than it is.
Whereas asteroid 2709 Sagan is known as the Sagan asteroid for all time, and it's known that way.
Well, I mean, I didn't ask for it to be named after me, but...
No, but it's an honor that you probably received.
And I'm very grateful.
Though, of course, living on some planet revolving around some sun in Andromeda, and you know of the same asteroid, you don't call it Sagan.
If you're an extraterrestrial, you have quite a different set of designations, of course.
And we are out of time. Couldn't resist working then at this last minute. Thanks to all for listening. Back again tomorrow night for a full 2-hour program with the guys who run the Better Business Bureau of Chicago.